I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Building smarter, more humane cities is the aim of all of our guests today. Greg Fewson and Sandra Cully are the people behind The Vine, an annual West Coast gathering of creative architects, builders, philosophers, and artists. Their topic at this year's Vine conference is the nature of community. Also with us are Ruth Otte and Clifford Young, who together have produced an invaluable survey for urban enthusiasts to uncover what people around the world like and don't like about their cities. Cliff is Senior Vice President for Ipsos, who conducted the survey, and Ruth heads Marketing Communications for Veolia Transportation. Plus, our regular contributors, Nate Berg and Walker Smith, coming up today on Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Our first guests today are Greg Fewson and Sandra Cully. Greg is Vice President of Content Development for the Pacific Coast Builders Conference, or PCBC. Sandra is the President of Cully Marketing and Advisory Board Member for The Vine. The Vine began as an offshoot of the PCBC, one of the largest home building trade shows in the U.S., but has now grown into a sister enterprise that focuses on the building of communities rather than just homes. The Vine bills itself as a conference on the nature of community. What is the nature of community today?
I think the nature of community is really at a state of flux right now. I mean, you can look at it a number of different ways, and that's one of the things that The Vine was created to do, not just in the physical sense, but also in social and environmental. And I think you have to really lump them all together to get a holistic view of the state of community today. The purpose of The Vine was to bring together a group that originated from the development industry, so therefore physical communities, but also expand the conversation and incorporate perspectives from creators of community on a number of different realms: artists, teachers, musicians, anthropologists, city leaders, scientists, really trying to make it a much broader conversation, because essentially we don't think the world needs another conference of developers talking to themselves.
Greg, is there an appetite today with developers to talk about the nature of community and sort of this expanded conversation about community when, you know, when the development business is so in the tank?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. And that was one of the things that we observed and made us want to create a conference like The Vine in the first place. We really consider one of our organizational core purposes to be driving the kinds of conversations that the home building and community development industries are having. And as we look around at the landscape and keep our ear open to the kinds of dialogues that are being held, we saw that there was a real lack of discussion about community on the level of really humanity and the deep personal connections that people have to the places and spaces around them. And so The Vine was created to kind of fill that void and create the kind of conversation about deeper issues that take development beyond just a real estate transaction, but look at the human underpinnings that are beneath it.
Sandra, you work with so many developers in helping them sort of shape the story of their developments and so forth. When they think about building community, those that do think about building community, what are the tools that they have to put to work in building community? But how do they even approach it?
It depends on the developer or builder, the approach to developing community. In today's market, I think the conversation about community has even greater power than when we were in the go-go years of real estate appreciation, where people were thinking of home as an investment rather than as a place to live. And I think that the very best developers and builders today are continuing to do well in a very tough economy because they've thought about what it means beyond the physical space of living in a home or a condo to the larger aspect of the intangible benefits of being in a neighborhood and a community. I'm just thinking about builders and what The Vine does and how it gives you a perspective of looking way out ahead instead of looking in the rearview mirror. Toyota and Prius, the conversation that must have occurred in their laboratory when they were thinking about how could we do something that's good for people, good for the environment, and that has a market out there. And by the time we, GM, the big three, woke up in this country, they own that market. So for developers, today is a great time for them to be thinking about what is the equivalent in community of the Prius. How do we think about it now? How do we plan for it? And how do we bring it to market?
Yeah, that's a great analogy, Sandra. And when you think about that, what's the Prius for real estate builders?
I think one of the interesting things builders are doing right now is talking to people who are in their teens, because 10 years out, those are your buyers of your first set of housing that you're offering. And there is a change in that group of people, the millennials, it's not changing among them, it's different from what came before them, with a tremendous appreciation for environmental sustainability, maybe being a one-car family instead of a three-car family. The way in which they want to live in the world is quite different than, let's say, my leading-edge baby boomer group, of which I'm a part. I know there's a community in Vancouver that's called Electric Avenue, and they've included in their high-rise condominium two or three electric cars that can be used by people who are in the building. So, in fact, you have enough money because you don't own a car that you can afford a payment to own a condominium and still have wheels when you need them. I think the Prius for developers and builders is not only how do people live smartly with respect for the environment, but how do they also have fun? And I think the Prius for a while was, when it was first purchased by people, it was like if you're a true blue greenie, then you're going to have that car. And now it's a ton of people drive Priuses who are also people who go to nightclubs. I think it's not just the true greens, the people who are the Berkeleyites, but the broader majority of people who are looking at ways to make the world a better place. And so the Prius for developers has to be a vibrant, wonderful place to live that's probably not the subdivision that your parents bought 40, 50 years ago.
Well, it brings up a point, Greg. With real estate, there's the product, there's the neighborhood, there's the broader community, and then there's the story about all of that connected together. In your experience, Greg, in working with builders and developers, what is the hierarchy of meaning and importance to each of those layers, and is that changing?
Well, I think it's definitely changing. I think that there's an awareness now that that needs to be brought much more clearly to the forefront, that the kinds of communities that are still selling in a down market are those that really maximize on that element of it.
Yes, I think the story is written by the consumer, and those builders who are smart enough to talk to them early on and listen to them can tell compelling stories about what our challenge in building new construction is to preview for people what life will be like before it's there.
Yeah, how do you do that? That's so interesting. I love this idea, and you and I have talked about it a bit before. Tell me how you coach builders into doing that, or salespeople that, you know, have to sell that product.
I think the best way to demonstrate what the future will be like is to experience it today. And the easiest way to do that is to think about what are the aspects of this community that people would enjoy. It might be that you know that you're in a neighborhood where there will be a bunch of people who are bike riders, and you can bring together your prospects, talk about bike riding, take them on a bike ride, meet afterwards, hang out, and just talk. I think it's providing the space for people to hang out with people who have some of the same values they have, want to do some of the same things, and then realize that if they pick this neighborhood, this is what they'll be doing when they move in.
I want to sort of circle back to the Vine, because I think this is a really interesting gathering you've put together. You talk about the Vine as giving attendees the courage to do something important and something human. And Greg, you've already alluded to that notion of community as being human, something beyond the real estate transaction. Tell me about the Vine and how you orchestrate it, design it, so that people, even in a very troubled economy, can come and have that experience that indeed gives them the courage to do something important and human.
You know, one of the things that was really interesting and telling to me, the first conference that we held of the Vine, which was in 2006, at the conclusion of it, this was a very different kind of offering that we had ever done before. And we set out to create this deep exploration of what community means. And to have that kind of conversation about community really means to have that kind of conversation about what it means to be human and what it means to connect with one another. At the conclusion of that first conference, the outpouring of gratitude that we received from the people who attended was absolutely astounding. And I don't say that to pat myself on the back. I was blown away when people were lining up to come thank me and give me hugs and say, you created something that we really needed that was lacking in our industry. I can tell you, I've been putting on conferences for 14 years. I like to think I'm pretty good at my job. I've never had a conference inspire people to come give me hugs before. So that kind of told me we're on to something here. We're creating something. We're opening up a dialogue that hasn't been happening but needs to be happening.
Tell me about the speakers this year. Tell me the dates and then the speakers. Who will be at the Vine?
The dates are October 1st through the 3rd. It's going to be in San Diego at the Rancho Bernardo Inn. We have a fascinating lineup of speakers who at first glance may not appear to be connected all that tightly, but are going to be woven into, I think, a very interesting discussion that begins at a broad, wide open look at the whole wide world, almost to a dizzying effect, and studying what's going on out there, what are the big issues, what are the big challenges of our time. And then slowly beginning to move that discussion into a much more tangible, actionable dimension. One of the ways that this is created is through a phenomenal facilitator whose name is Chris Grant. He's a professional facilitator. He describes himself as a builder of bridges. And he is kind of the thread that weaves the discussion and the speaking topics from one to another, but also pulling the audience into a much more participative role than they may be used to. One of the elements that we are building into this year's conference that I'm very excited about is what we're calling an innovation lab, where the participants, fed by some of the discussions that are being led by our presenters, are going to be tasked with breaking into small random groups and essentially beginning to brainstorm and prototype and present back to the rest of the group new business enterprises or products or services that they see an opportunity for in response to the challenges out there in the marketplace.
And describe the place. I know that the place that houses the Vine is very important to you.
It really is. I mean, we look at a conference like this and the place and the environment has to be woven into the fabric of the experience. The Rancho Bernardo Inn is a privately held resort. It's in northern San Diego County. It is about a mile or two from some of the neighborhoods that were devastated by the wildfires last year. We held our breaths a little bit waiting to see if there would be a resort in the aftermath of that. Thankfully, it was untouched. And in the midst of that, the resort itself, which has been at the core of that community for a number of years since it was built, actually became kind of a refuge for community rehabilitation by providing housing, meals, and respite for not only the families who lost their homes in the fires, but also the rescue workers who were involved in the cleanup effort.
It seems like part of what you're striving for in this conversation that you have at the Vine is getting to that deeper meaning. Again, what is authentically human, and it seems to reflect this growing interest in and value on authenticity. Sandra, can authenticity be baked into new homes and new communities?
That's a great question. I think the word authenticity, it has such ubiquity, exactly like sustainability, that you start to doubt just the word itself as being authentic. I've been reading a book by Gerald Zaltman called Marketing Metaphoria, and it alludes to what deep metaphors reveal about us and our minds. And I think authenticity is fundamental to neighborhood, and it's not about new or old. It's something in human beings. And so if a brand new community brings together people in ways that matter to them, what those deep metaphors mean to people about home and family. Family could be a dog, it could be a child, it could be you alone with your friends. Family is defined so many different ways in the U.S. today. And I think that authenticity is easily done in new developments if we're thoughtful. I guess what I love about the Vine is that in a 2.5-3 day period, it allows you to have exceptional conversations that gives you the freedom to think about things you, in your everyday crazy world, don't have time to do. And it also combines it, for me, with a feeling of being at camp, where you've had those deep conversations with friends deep into the night. And when you leave camp, you're still incredibly connected to those people. That's the kind of friends you make at the Vine.
I love the way you talk about the Vine, both of you. But I want to come back to authenticity, because I do think you're absolutely right. You begin to doubt the authenticity of the word itself. But what would be the physical manifestations? It's one thing to talk about bringing people together and making it easy for family, however you define family, to connect with others. But what's the physical manifestation of that? How do you bring that into being? How do you encourage that, enable that?
I think the physical design of a community does affect interaction. I think walkable communities, which we've heard about a lot recently, people running into each other and talking. If you, in a new community, driven by the U.S. Postal Service to not have individual delivery to houses, are ganging together all the delivery of mail, it's very easy in a new community to establish a gathering place, so that not only are you there for the task of picking up your mail, but you might meet another friend with a dog or sit down on a bench and have a conversation. So if we are thoughtful about the gathering places we create and the public and private realm and the blending between the two, that can make for places where people can slow down enough to see friends and talk and not be subjected to email, faxes, phones, instant messaging, and all the other ways technology has turned our lives into crazy busy. I think that developers can design places that allow people to slow down and talk to each other again.
I'll add another thought to that that's not a specific solution like I think you were hoping for, and that is find a way to put a mouse on it. Here's what I mean by that. Clay Shirky, in his book, Here Comes Everybody, well, he tells a story about a time that he spent with some friends, and they were hanging out. And one of them had a 4-year-old daughter, so they put on a DVD for the girl. She's watching the movie. A little while later, she pops back behind the TV, starts rooting around in the cables. The girl's dad says, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I'm looking for the mouse." To her way of thinking, a video about Dora that didn't have a mouse attached to it, that didn't allow her to participate in the experience, wasn't worth sitting still for. And so Clay Shirky draws this conclusion from it. And he's specifically talking about media applications, but I think there's a perfect crossover here. He says, media that's targeted at you but doesn't include you may not be worth sitting still for. You substitute media for places, and I think you can begin to think about how do you put a mouse on physical experiences that draw people into it more.
Oh, I love that analogy. We had Clay on the show a couple of months ago. I just love his book, Here Comes Everybody. As the economy recovers, you both, your lives are full of developers and builders. Do you expect them to pick up where they left off, or do you expect them to take a really different approach to their business?
I think both. I think once the pressure's off, some people will go back to doing it like they've done it, and they will not be as successful. I think there are a lot of people right now in boardrooms thinking about how do we plan for the future in different ways. And I think that there is, in terms of consumers, if you think about what people are looking for, we are rewriting the way development's been done. I think Joel Kotkin is the one who said that there'll always be a place for suburbia, and there'll always be people who want a cul-de-sac. The array of products that will be offered in the future by new home developers, new creators of new places, will be broader than it's been in the past.
I also like to think that the consumer climate has changed too, and will change as younger generations move through the home buying cycle. Looking at what's playing out in the world of Web 2.0 and social networking, and you could have a whole discussion around, is that healthy community or not? Essentially, what it's doing is creating an architecture of participation. And I'd like to think that the same expectations that are playing out in that realm are going to start to carry over to the physical realm as well.
And to get more information about the Vine, we'll certainly put a link on our website at smartcityradio.com. But to go directly to information, where do you go?
www.thevineconference.com.
TheVineConference.com. Okay, we'll check it out. Sandra, Greg, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
Greg Fewson is the cultivator of the Vine, and Sandra Cully serves on its advisory board. This year, the Vine will take place October 1st through 3rd in San Diego, California. This interview was engineered by The Garage in Los Angeles. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
With hundreds of the country's top Democratic leaders all converging into one location, ensuring security at the Democratic National Convention is a top priority. The age of terrorism has many standing on pins about what could possibly go wrong when the convention moves into Denver this year. As a result, the Secret Service has issued an order that seeks to keep out one of the modern world's most notorious terror threats, bicycles. The Denver Independent reports that the Secret Service is banning all bike parking at the convention, mainly over fears that critical mass riders will come around and cause a ruckus, like some say they did in New York in 2004 for the GOP convention. So as the Democratic Party seeks to throw one of the greenest national conventions in history, they're blocking out one of the greenest forms of transportation. Meanwhile, forward-thinking residents in the San Francisco Bay Area are coming up against a little dilemma. On one hand, they have embraced the concept of slow food, a European-spawned idea that has city folk focusing more on growing their own food locally. On the other hand is infill development, a pattern of development that encourages the use of underutilized sites within the urban core rather than empty spaces that are far away. These two seemingly civic-minded ideas, however, are butting heads, as infill development is taking away land the slow food movement wants to use for urban farming, and vice versa. A recent op-ed in the Berkeley Daily Planet argues that in the battle between infill and slow food, infill development will most often win. Local food advocates will need to keep this in mind as they attempt to bring their food to the local level. And finally, as the economy continues to struggle, the prospect of the privatization of public services is becoming increasingly attractive to governments. As budget deficits rise, cities and states are expected to consider selling off some of their expensive public services for private funding and operation. A recent article from Reuters interviewed bankers and economists and government officials and found that the current economic state is warming more and more hearts to the idea. Toll roads in Chicago and Pennsylvania are attracting private investors, and governments are hesitant to turn down offers to take over their costly infrastructure. And with rising prices worldwide, the idea of raising taxes to support local infrastructure is not incredibly popular. So infrastructure is up for sale. And while the economy remains in the state it is, much more can be expected on the auction block. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll find out all about how people feel about life in cities from Ruth Otte and Clifford Young. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Ruth Otte is the executive vice president of marketing and communications for Veolia Transportation. Clifford Young is the senior vice president with Ipsos, a social research and public affairs firm. Together, they've created a survey for Veolia Observatory of Urban Lifestyles called Life in the City. What did you hope to learn from this survey?
Well, Veolia commissioned this survey to really more deeply understand how people feel about living in cities, what they like, what they dislike, what they feel about the future, their level of confidence or concern, all the dimensions of city life we wanted to get closer to and understand better.
And it's a big survey, but what did you learn?
Well, we learned many things. We learned that people have intense feelings of pride and attachment and emotional connection to their cities. We learned that they love the diversity of activity, all the options for going out, the cultural activities, the economic opportunities. And we learned that there's also things they don't like.
Clifford, what are some of those things they don't like?
On the one hand, people are attracted to cities because of the cultural offerings, because of the things they can do in terms of leisure and social activities. Of course, the economic pull is especially important, and particularly in non-U.S. cities. We can come back and even talk about that in more detail. But people across the globe don't like the things that all of us who live in big cities don't like. We don't like grit and grime and dirt. We don't like crime. And we certainly don't like the cost of living. Well, we state at least we don't like the cost of living, but we still live in those places because of the positive points. But looking at overall, we also see that traffic congestion is a primary factor that people criticize. I think it's important to emphasize that the reason or genesis of the survey, when we think of public policy and putting together public policy initiatives in urban centers, it's very important to remember that there's really two components you have to take into consideration. On the one hand, there's the technical, the expert component, you know, what the experts think should be done in respect to urban planning. But equally important is what people want, what the urban denizens or citizens need and want and demand. And without optimizing those two sets of variables, you have a misfit in terms of your public policy. So going back to a more specific point, we learned like very interesting things. We expected great variability from city to city. And while there is variability, we find many similarities. Many similarities in terms of what people like and dislike, what they demand and don't demand. And that's very important from a public policy perspective. Why? Because that suggests that learning from one place can be applied to public policy initiatives in another place.
And you mentioned, I know cost of living was an issue, and yet people are still living in cities, and they're living in cities in ever greater numbers. So if I'm a public official and I'm trying to evaluate your survey findings, Clifford, trying to understand what is it that an urban leader should get from the survey and say, I need to work on that.
Well, first, I think cost of living, of course, is something that people are just going to declare. So there's an issue of value for services or value for money. In other words, it might cost a lot, but am I getting something out of it? That's the first point. So you have to have offerings, especially cultural, social, and leisure, that make up for those negatives. There is a certain percentage of the population that is increasingly having problems living in the cities, and that is lower-income individuals. And that's problematic. Why is that problematic? And we're seeing this across the globe and across the United States. How do you keep individuals that typically feel certain sort of occupations, how do you keep them closer to where they work? And those are huge issues we're facing. So I would say in terms of cost of living, value for what you get, value for services. On the other hand, you have to have policies that make sure that you have mixed groups of individuals, mixed income groups with the possibility of living in big places.
Ruth, I know that your firm provides transportation solutions to cities globally. And it's interesting, I recently did a tour of several I think I was in 10 cities in 11 days, and it seems like 9 of them were talking about transit. Transit was the number one issue they were worried about now. What do we do? I'm curious, what are cities doing? Congestion is a big issue that for people that you surfaced in the survey. Many cities are responding to congestion. Understanding now it's hard to build yourself out of congestion with more highway lanes, so let's go to transit or let's go to alternative transportation. Tell me what cities are doing.
Well, there are some very interesting things happening around the globe to increase personal mobility in cities. And it starts with an integrated view. The cities that are leading and doing the best are thinking from this perspective. When you are at your home, we want to give you options for you to take your car or a little circulator that takes you to a light rail stop or a BRT, which is a bus that looks like a train that's in dedicated lanes that has traffic signal prioritization so it moves kind of like a train without having to build tracks.
BRT stands for Bus Rapid Transit.
Thank you, Bus Rapid Transit. So the most innovative cities are taking this perspective that the downtown areas need to have green spaces and walkable areas and outdoor cafes and places for people to do what they like to do in cities, connect to each other, enjoy music, be outside. But they need to also have ways to get there. So they're making coordinated plans for transit and mobility along with planting trees, making pedestrian walkways, so that removing cars from the urban center and enabling people to get there easily in multiple ways through light rail, through a bus rapid transit system, through a bus system that's connected very closely to the train schedule. So they think of it like from a high level, like having a master control center where all the schedules are coordinated so that you can go from one mode to the other with minimal wait times and maximum convenience. And from the perspective of mobility is a very, very important part of enjoying city life.
How are cities organized to look at personal mobility at that big level? It seems to me that sometimes one of the problems is that you have one agency thinking about transit, one agency thinking about highways, one agency thinking about the regional transportation system versus the local transportation system. I mean, there seems to be a lot of fragmentation when it comes to who makes the transit decisions and who's looking at it from the broadest perspective. What do you find in the cities where they're able to make good decisions rapidly about personal mobility?
It's just what you said. It's an integrated perspective coming from the viewpoint of the passenger. In other words, looking at transportation like a city's lifeblood, like moving people around, getting them where they need to go as interconnection of modes. In other words, there's a deliberate strategy to coordinate and plan highways, parking, dedicated lanes for high occupancy vehicles with BRT, with rail. So the cities that are really pioneering have brought together an Uber perspective about mobility, and they're thinking integration. They're thinking integration, and they're thinking also one card or one cell phone option so that no messes around with five tickets or five different systems or confusing things. So it's integration in every way. Texting you when your train or bus is late, giving the schedule right online with your text. I mean, there's amazing things happening in some European cities that we're really hoping the U.S. will model after here now that gas prices are reaching such concern.
I just wanted to chime in a little bit about this question. What we find across the globe that there are problems in decision-making in respect to transportation because it's not just a local, specific, municipal issue, for instance. So you have overlapping government bodies. We have an especially problematic situation here in the U.S. because we have so many governing bodies. You take other countries where you perhaps make all decisions at the state level or even at the federal level. And of course, making decisions in such a centralized way has some of its drawback as well. But we see some easier models and easier decision-making models in those cases. But I would say that independently of how the decision-making structure is organized, we find that cross-cutting bodies and working groups that are designed to do long-term planning in those places, and I'll give an example, Curitiba, Brazil, which has a wonderful transportation, integrated transportation system. Of course, it's a smaller city, 2 million, which helps, as an example of how overarching institutions that cut across different bodies can help both in short-term decision-making and long-term planning.
I want to ask, where do you go to see the future, Ruth, in terms of transportation?
Well, you could go, for example, to Bordeaux, France, or to Nice and have a beautiful trip and see urban centers that have been revitalized because cars have been removed and they've been renovated with fountains and trees and where there's light rail and multiple BRT lines and coordinated bus schedules and one cell phone that gets you through all the a cell phone or a smart pass, but when integrated ticketing. And you could see there just tremendous consumer response. And there are definitely some cities doing very interesting things here. Salt Lake City has a master plan that includes light rail and very elaborate plan for transportation. Portland, there's a lot happening here as well. Another amazing place to go would be to go to Bogota, Colombia, where they built a BRT system where a very sleek bus comes every 90 seconds and 1 million people a day travel of their 5 million total population travel every day. So if a bus comes every 90 seconds and they move in dedicated lanes and there's very rapid and efficient ticketing, they have reduced commute times from 90 minutes to 35 minutes across the city in 5 years. And they have reduced air pollution 40%, and it's cost way less than rail. And eventually they're going to add rail lines as well. They are projecting that by 2015, 5 million of their 7 million population will ride their BRT system, improving safety, mobility, and air quality. And they've also had an urban renewal plan connected to it. So they're one really interesting example that our company operates part of the system there, so we know it well.
That's a great example. Clifford, I had to laugh when I looked at the survey. If I read it right, you tell me if I'm wrong. It looked like the places that were most car dependent were fussing the most about congestion. Did they ever like put two and two together? Like, we drive a lot, so maybe it's the reason we're congested.
No. Yeah. Your question. No, exactly. You're talking specifically about the United States.
Yes.
Where we're highest on car usage across the 14 global cities that we looked at, and we also complain the most about congestion. And what's interesting about that, if you look at other data in the survey, while on the one hand we complain here in the United States about congestion, and we're using cars, of course, creating the congestion, right? We're creating congestion for ourselves, right? On the other hand, the importance of public transportation is lower than it should be, or at least that we thought it should be. And what does that suggest to us? That suggests to us that the debate about transportation and congestion in the United States still has not been framed in such a way where people necessarily connect to two things. People do not necessarily say, congestion is a car problem and we have a non-car solution. Now, we believe, based upon our polling and the kind of trends we're seeing, that if we stay at the high levels of gas that we're seeing now, that this debate will begin to reframe itself. That is, people will begin to make the connection between congestion and non-car solutions. But we're still not there yet in the United States. So in other words, people think about it separately. Transportation is one thing. Using car and car congestion is another thing.
One thing that is changing in the U.S. is that for many, many years, we all said to ourselves, well, we'll never get Americans out of their cars. And I will tell you that that is absolutely not true. When people are given convenient, well-designed, attractive solutions, you know, like the light rail system in Salt Lake City or Denver, when they built it, they came. They came in droves. And since gas has hit $4, across the country, ridership is up 15, sometimes 20%. Just for commuter express buses that now exist in many cities in the U.S., you know, slick buses that take you downtown. So I think that Cliff is right that up till now we haven't fully connected the dots, but once you offer people in the U.S. who had been using their cars good solutions, they absolutely come. It's just that we have, in many cases, since the Eisenhower era, we've mostly invested in roads in many cities, excluding New York and D.C. and maybe Chicago. Most of our cities we've way underfunded. And now we believe the time is coming where people will want these options, especially if gas goes even higher, and where there'll be the political will to fund the price tag.
I just wanted to add that polling data actually shows that when you give them the option, when you say, if you had the option between a car and some mode of public transportation, people tend to opt for the public mode. But up to now, there hasn't been actually the option, this option, in many places in an objective way.
What are the dimensions of public transportation that have to be in place for people to make that choice? I know you've also looked at the push side as well. I mean, that's the demand side. The push side is price of gasoline, right? There's a magic price per gallon that starts to move people in big, big ways toward transit.
Yes, our data, we're looking at price. Our data is showing, our polling has shown over the last year or so that it's between 4 and 5. In other words, I wouldn't say we're at the tipping point. We're near the tipping point. Are we a little bit past the tipping point, a little bit behind the tipping point? We're not quite sure yet. But this is when people begin to seriously think about alternative modes. They just have to have an alternative mode.
What makes an alternative mode a real alternative? I mean, Ruth, you're talking about it in sort of broad stroke terms. There are obviously headways. There's the, you know, there's the convenience, there's the time on. I mean, what are some of those dimensions that you look at to say, this is what a public transit system has to have? This is the test it has to pass.
It's really simple what people want. They want whatever it is, the train or the bus or the bus rapid transit, they want it to come regularly. They want it to be reliable. They want it to be convenient. If they drive their car there, they want the parking to be available. I mean, people globally are not asking for some outlandish thing. You know, they're not asking for lattes to be served to them on board. They really just want to get there and move. So it's the frequency and the reliability and the convenience. And if one thing connects to another, they don't want to stand there in the rain for 20 minutes. You know, they want connection points in urban centers where points intersect, that the schedules are connected and where it's convenient to go. It's really not that that's easy to do, but that what they want is real straightforward.
One of the things I was very interested in this survey, and you've both already mentioned it, is the prominence of cultural offerings in what people value in cities. And this echoes a survey actually that we had commissioned earlier with Celinda Lake, where we found the same thing. We found people talking far more about culture than I would have ever imagined. What do you make of that?
especially in the United States, we have to realize that in U.S. cities and cities outside the United States, and I want to overgeneralize, are very different in some ways. Why? The United States is very different. In the United States, we have multiple economic centers. So you can work in many places. And so cities are a special choice. On the flip side, Paris, France, or London, Sao Paulo, Brazil, Beijing, China, basically the economic center is the cultural center, is the political center. So you have this confluence of types of centers. In the U.S., no. We have places, great examples are Kodak in Rochester, New York, which is a small city, Microsoft in Seattle. So you have all these choices. So big cities, people are not driven there only because of economic reasons. So the kind of person that's being attracted to these places is being attracted, of course, because the jobs are there. There are good jobs there. But because these global cities have something to offer them above and beyond that. And one of the most striking findings from the study, in a general sense, was that global cities were attraction points for cultural offerings, as you were saying, Carol. But more specifically in the United States, the U.S. residents trended highest on diversity. So people are looking for diversity, difference, richness, whether that be cultural or social. And in the United States, we have choice. We can live in a small place and have a great job. We can live in a big place, have a great job, and have certain cultural offerings that we wouldn't have in a small place. So that's how I would read the results.
You know, I think you brought up diversity as well, which I also think it's always seemed like diversity was the politically correct thing to say you value, right? We value diversity. And you hear cities make that pitch all the time. I thought it was really interesting when you ask people anonymously what they value. They value diversity. They do. Did that surprise you?
No, once again, I think we have to realize that people that are attracted, especially in the United States because of the reasons I outlined before, people that are attracted to big cities are attracted to certain sorts of things. So those people that are not as interested in those sorts of things are living in other places. So we have to realize that New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and some of our other big global cities are attracting people because of those reasons. So I think it makes perfect sense.
It was very specific, the high level of appreciation of diversity of people. Diversity of course, they said diversity of economic options, social options, cultural offerings, but the diversity of different kinds of people, it was something really appreciated in all these large cities around the globe.
There are things that people love about cities, and then the flip side of them is they hate about cities, because on the one hand, they love the diversity, but they also worry about their comfort level. They love the dynamism of the city and all the people, the choice that, you know, concentration of people brings, but they don't like the congestion. So there are these really interesting push-pulls. And I thought one of the most interesting things to me was your finding that people can feel very isolated in cities. And it seems to me that's actually something that urban leaders can do something about. I'm curious, what was your reaction to that finding, and do you see a public policy response in that?
Well, as a full half of the people of the survey expressed that at times they feel isolated, lonely, and a sense of anonymity, that if something happened to them, the city would march on and keep going, and everybody would go home for dinner and do whatever they do. And, you know, I've always felt that myself in the, you know, Grand Central Station at rush hour, where there's such a mass of humanity in one place. But it was fascinating to find that that is really universal. That was true in all, across all cities. And I think there, in terms of green spaces and spaces for people to connect and to feel their humanity and enjoy a fresh breeze or music or a fountain or children playing or a library. I mean, that's certainly one of the obvious public policy aspects of this, is that we need that sense of connection, and we need it even though we're surrounded by lots of other people.
Yeah, I was going to reinforce the same point. In other words, the initiatives that, in terms of green spaces, museum and interactive museum spaces are places, open places where people can learn. Sports are very important and a very central way to interconnect. I think being in Chicago, we'll talk a little bit about Chicago. Chicago has a very good public sports program here. And so there's a number of ways which public officials can deal with this issue, but definitely it's a problem not just here in the U.S., but it's a problem globally.
If you were to summarize this survey for an urban leader and say, here are the implications for you, let me give you the top three things that you need to focus on, what would those three things be?
Okay, I guess I'll take the first stab. Maximize what people want. What do they want? They want cultural offering, they want choice, they want diversity. Okay? Minimize what they don't want. They don't want urban grit, noise, crime, and congestion. And more specifically about the United States, it's transportation stupid. In other words, the big issue, and independently of the price question, the price of gas, transportation will increasingly be an issue that will have to be dealt with, and people are demanding, especially in the United States, people are demanding that.
Ruth, give me your three.
The interconnection between transportation and mobility with congestion and air quality, it's very poignant. And the things that Cliff was saying, from designing mobility to enable more green spaces and more, all these things are interconnected in a way that transportation is the root of it, but also thinking through how will people connect here and breathe and enjoy each other and interact with each other. So to me, those were the biggest findings. It surprised us, I think, the degree to which the things they don't like have implications for transportation. So all the concerns they expressed for the future were about quality of the air, quality of the environment, quality of noise, you know, mobility beyond cost of living. Those were the things that came to the top when you asked people about their concerns for the future. And they're things that I think all of us worry about. In the survey, many people were concerned about the projected increases of population that their cities are, you know, forecast to have, and how will pollution, air quality, mobility, green spaces, quality of the environment, and be affected by that was on their minds. So that, first and foremost, is that kind of planning seems to be the message they were trying to ask their leaders to do.
Do you plan to repeat this survey?
We do. We are going to do the survey every other year.
Great.
And take a look at how these feelings about city life change over time.
Great. And the findings are online.
The findings are online on veoliaenvironment.com.
Great. And we'll put a link on our site as well to that survey. It's great work, and we appreciate so much you're doing it. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Ruth Oddie is the Executive Vice President of Marketing and Communications for Veolia Transportation. Clifford Young is the Senior Vice President with Ipsos. They joined us in our offices in Chicago. This week, Walker Smith looks ahead and he sees the end of the American empire. But our City Views commentator says a future of cooperation doesn't look so bleak.
According to many pundits, America is over the hill. Our days of dominating global economics and world politics are behind us. The future, they say, will be run by China and India, with Russia, Venezuela, and Iran in supporting roles. Maybe these worst-case prognostications are right. Maybe not. Right or wrong, though, the future will be different. However strong America remains, the future will no longer be ours to dictate. Other countries no longer depend on America or need us as much as before. Journalist Fareed Zakaria has written in his new book, The Post-American World, that other countries are not so much hostile to the U.S. these days as they are self-absorbed. With strong prospects of their own, they have no reason to worry with America. In fact, as Zakaria points out, many of the things that America has promoted for decades, like free trade and open borders, have made stronger players of others, thus weakening our domination of both markets and diplomacy. What has strengthened others has moderated our influence. Yet, just as this is occurring, we are looking ahead at a world in which we must get along to get by. We can no longer protect our own interest unilaterally. We need the participation and cooperation of others. Perhaps this is no clearer than when it comes to energy and the environment. As gasoline prices skyrocket, we see the necessity for moderating total demand in order to keep prices affordable. Otherwise, we won't be able to afford even our basic needs for gas and perhaps even food for our families. Cooperative agreements are essential here. The same thing is true of global warming and climate change. We will avoid the worst consequences of climate change only if all nations, especially China, agree to join in the effort. We cannot solve this problem in isolation. But securing the participation of other countries means a change in U.S. policies and approaches. We cannot demand of other countries what we ourselves are unwilling to do. Indeed, as we have discovered in areas like fighting terrorism or protecting the world's fisheries, the scope of the challenges is too vast and too knotty to be remedied alone. We must begin by making sacrifices ourselves if we are to inspire others to make needed sacrifices of their own. We can no longer bend the world to our selfish interest. The world will bend to us only if we are willing to bend ourselves. Author and political pundit Kevin Phillips makes the case in his new book, Bad Money, that recent U.S. foreign policy actions have eroded confidence in the U.S. to such a degree that oil-producing nations have begun to diversify their currency holdings. Most no longer require that oil be paid for in dollars and now accept the yen and the euro. The result is a much weaker dollar that is taking an ever bigger bite out of our pocketbooks. We must face up to this new world and realize that we can no longer protect our interests by acting unilaterally with little regard for the interest of others. It is a future to come in which America remains powerful, just not as all-powerful as before. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. We love hearing from you. You can shoot us an email, questions@smartcityradio.com, or contact us through our website, smartcityradio.com. While you're there, you can listen to past shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, check out our links to our guest work. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer, engineer, and 2008 Olympic deadlift silver medal winner. I'm Carol Coletta.